The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
There's a new book out called A History of Ireland in 10 Body Parts. It is by Dr. Ian Miller, who is an author and senior lecturer in medical history at Ulster University. And through the lens of the 10 body parts, it treats a vast spectrum ranging from why Irish people have red hair to how we may have been responsible for creating the guillotine to why the potato is so handy in so many different ways. Ian, it's lovely to see you.
Thank you.
Let us start with bog bodies, because you have a lot of interesting history derived from people that we have dug out of the bog over the years.
Yeah, I kind of start with the Clonicarvan man, who's one of Ireland's oldest faces. You can go and see him at the National Museum of Ireland, which I did when I moved to Dublin in 2009, and I was really fascinated. You can see some of his hair. You can still make out his eyes almost looking at you. He almost looks alive, and it's a really different experience than just looking at a skull, because you can see the skin, and it really feels like you're looking at a real, well, you are looking at a real person from a few thousand years ago.
And an interestingly modern person, because they've redone him based on what they have found archaeologically. And he, if you put him in a shirt, he could be walking around town now.
Yeah, he kind of has a ponytail. He looks very much like something from the 1990s, to be quite honest. And but they found the interesting thing about his hair was that scientists did an investigation and they found that he used hair gel, which you wouldn't kind of expect someone from 2 or 3 millennia ago to be going around with hair gel.
And he had a sort of a hipster goatee as well.
He did have a goatee. Yeah, yeah. But just by examining what the hair gel was made from, they realised that they had trading connections in Ireland with the Mediterranean back then, which was kind of unexpected. So I guess that from looking at the body and different body parts, you can really build up a big social and cultural history of Ireland.
Let's look at some of the body parts that you focus on. One is the stomach, and that brings us to potatoes and the value to the Irish diet and how good a diet it is if you live entirely on spuds and a bit of milk.
Well, yeah, it's a very nutritious product. It's lacking a few vitamins, but generally speaking, if you live on potatoes alone, the benefits are that you are generally strong and healthy. Of course, the downside is that if you over-rely on one crop, then famine can become catastrophic, as it obviously was in the 1840s. It's interesting, when people went to prison in the 19th century, they were always measured. And if you look at the records over time, you see that people shrunk after the famine. People generally got smaller in Ireland. And in my view, the diet actually got worse after the famine. It became more diverse. We were less dependent on one crop. But people relied on white bread, tea, kind of cheaper products that aren't as nutritious. So you can really see a health decline. So in the book, I do talk about the 1890s, when people of an older age are looking back to the 1840s and thinking, God, everyone looked a bit taller, a bit healthier, a bit happier back then.
You also have a paragraph, I was going to say, a chapter on height and Irish giants, including a man who was, 7'9"?
Well, so they claimed in the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries, people who were born exceptionally tall often put themselves on display and they would make a lot of money. So I guess it's the equivalent of the freak show. It was one of these. Now, we're a bit uncertain about how tall they were, because they tended to lie and say they were over 8 foot, you know, just to get the punters in. So there's a little bit of confusion about how tall they actually were. But by the standards of the day, they were really tall people. But there's a downside to that. These people often died at age 22, 23. They had very busy lives. They went over to England, made a profit in London. One of them, Charles Byrne, met the king. So they became real celebrities of the day. But by the age of 22, 23, they were disabled. They had leg problems because they struggled to bear their weight. And they had all sorts of genetic problems. So there's a real downside of this kind of disability.
And what do we assume, that it was a pituitary problem? Is that the thinking?
Yeah. Some of these bodies are still here. We've still got the skeletons, and scientists have gone and investigated them. And a lot of it is to do with pituitary problems.
There's a topic about still having the bodies. One of the things you cover is the theft of heads in Inishbofin.
Yeah, there's a lot of stolen bodies. So the book isn't just about people when they were alive, but the kind of afterlife of bodies and body parts. So just going back to the giants briefly. The surgeons in Britain really wanted to collect interesting bodies. So the giants of the time knew this. So they went to two great lengths to try to ensure that the surgeons and anatomists didn't go and dissect their body afterwards. They will try and get themselves placed in lead coffins, those kind of things, or buried at sea. But the anatomists, like John Hunter, always kind of outwitted them. So there is still giants in like the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh Museum.
Head theft, then.
Head theft, sorry, yeah. the Inishbofin schools. It was in the around 1900 or so, a lot of anthropologists started to go off to the Aran Islands and really remote places. They were really looking to see, well, what were Irish people like originally before the British came over, before the gene pool kind of got a bit mixed up. So they imagined that the places off the west coast of Ireland were these places where you could find a kind of prototype of an Irish person as such. Of course, it was all a bit imaginary at the time. The Irish cultural revival was going on, the build-up to independence and this kind of search for a new identity. So it was all imaginary. But you get people like John Millington Synge going over and kind of cultural figures as well. In relation to the schools, all they really seemed to do was measure them and try to find out, you know, what people looked like back then. It was a huge controversy. The anthropologists were quite disrespectful. They would go over and steal the schools, which the locals held a lot of value in, you know, as part of their heritage. And off they went and were stored at Trinity College. Now, then when I was writing the book, that debate was going on and Trinity returned the schools as I was writing the story. So I kept having to change things as I was going along.
And was that a function of the fad of phrenology? Were they trying to measure the skulls with a view to seeing could they interpret behaviour from them, or did they just want to anthropologically track what they thought ancestral Irish looked like?
It was a little bit of both. There was a phrenology, of course, where people are obsessed with criminals, for instance, and whether or not you can tell if someone's likely to be a criminal by the shape of the nose or the face or the cheeks and stuff that sounds very weird these days, I guess, but it made a lot of sense in the science of the day. But again, I think, you know, it encapsulates the point of the book in that bodies are really important, and body parts and not just living ones, but dead ones and the kind of meanings that people have. And you see this a lot in the more religious aspects of the book when I talk about relics and, you know, you've got St. Patrick's hand and those kind of things hold really personal meaning for different communities in Ireland over the...
Despite the importance of the body, you have a lot of outlining of how good we are at mistreating them, including... Yeah. Apparently a fad for drinking ether.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Ether in the 19th century had been discovered to be an anaesthetic. So until the 1840s, if you had an operation or an amputation, there would be very little in the way of pain relief, maybe a bit of alcohol if you're lucky, if you drank. If you didn't drink, you just had to get your leg chopped off, I guess. But ether was a substance and partly it became used for recreational purposes, particularly in the north, where there was a real strong anti-temperance movement and people stopped drinking. There was a real religious culture there which discouraged people from drinking alcohol. But ether had the same, well, very similar effects. So you could drink a load of it. It would be like drinking quite a lot of strong whiskey, by all accounts. And you would maybe have half an hour or so where you felt extremely kind of out of it, and then you'd suddenly recover. Wouldn't even have a hangover. So, you know, in many ways, it probably better than whiskey in that respect.
And it was significant enough that it got read from the altar. You have an instance in Mahara of a parish priest in the 1870s cursing ether in the hope that Catholics would no longer sell or consume it.
Yeah, because the trade in ether began to replace the trade in whiskey, so the church wasn't happy about that. And doctors as well are discussing it, even in Britain and different countries. They're discussing, why is everyone in Ulster drinking all this ether, and does it have any long-term health effects? What are the psychological and moral implications?
I talked about it briefly at the start. Let us go back there. How are we partially responsible for the guillotine?
Oh, well, I mean, the legend has it. There's a picture, basically, from the 12th century, an image, and it looks very much like a guillotine, but it's an Irish one. Now, obviously, the French Revolution happened in 1789, quite a few centuries afterwards, which is usually when we consider the guillotines would become popular. There's a more humane way of killing people than hanging them, in principle. But there is legends that these were in use in Ireland, and some people claim that the guillotine was invented over here. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's in the book.
Well, it's a point of pride. Ian, thank you very much and best of luck with the book. It is a riveting read. It is called A History of Ireland in 10 Body Parts. On our own, Luke O'Neill on the front saying a most compelling and truly remarkable read. And the author is Dr. Ian Miller.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.